I have the privilege now of introducing you to Catherine Rankovic. Catherine was born in Racine, Wisconsin. She's lived in St. Louis since 1988, having moved here to earn her MFA in poetry at Washington University. She is now an instructor at Merrimack Community College, a research assistant for the Department of African and African-American Studies at Washington University, a book reviewer for the Riverfront Times, and a contributing editor for St. Louis's newest literary magazine, Tornado Alley. She's very busy. If you've heard Catherine read before, or read one of her poems in Del Mar, Sou'wester, Gulf Coast, or River Styx, you are already aware of the sometimes cynical, sometimes irreverent accuracy of her poetry. You know her poems strike fast and hard, leaving a mark on the reader, a sharp sting. Her poems also make good use of humor, so that sting is tempered with a sardonic insight. If you haven't heard Catherine Rankovic read before, you're in for a real treat. We all are. I'd like you to welcome Catherine Rankovic.
Thank you, Anne. I always like to begin with this particular poem by way of introduction. I think all of us are very curious about the night we were conceived, something we can never quite know about. I was born in January 1957, so I'm imagining my parents 9 months before my birth. Conception. What did they talk of, my parents, in March 1956? Did my father speak English well enough to tell my mother how to mix his drink, how the dinner was? What did they have? Was my mother wearing her white nylon anklets that pinkened and clung as the dishwater dripped? Did she look in the gleaming, vacant sink when she was done, scrying the face of the fetus she'd lost on the bathroom floor at 20 weeks, just weeks before? Did she notice materials for my soul floating outside the window, two floors up, on the fuel of ailanthus buds, up from a soil of combustible trash? Did she see a ghost, perhaps, in the dark sky above the tannery? Ghosts of flayed cattle for their patron saint. How did her feet leave the floor of the bed, the linoleum printed to look like a rug, rich burgundies, greens, its furious chills burrowing up to the pelvic bones? How did they lie down? How did they prepare for the nightly train on the iron bridge 50 yards from the door, its Victorian roar? What was loose on the dresser? What crumbs of wood at the backs of the drawers shaken to dust? What followed the train, its aura of rust, scenting the air with iron ore? Did my father know his last letter home with the hand-colored photo of himself and his watch would make it to Belgrade by April 1, with the check enclosed to mother from son, drawn on an American bank? Did he know? I swung, half of me swung, as he lifted his gun and shot at the men who emerged from a tank, proud to die for the fatherland. How I felt the gun in my father's back that pointed him northward to Germany. Did he know me? Am I made of the stew he refused to eat, of antique vegetables, horses, meat, swept from corners and cellars, the best they could get? I was swinging in him in a frilly white dress, a fabric unwoven for 10 years yet. How did they sleep? Together in the central pit of the furnished mattress, rough to the skin, one on each side to dispel the sweat. Did my mother lie wakeful, shifting her thoughts through the purely unknown, scraps of streetlight littering the room, anonymous driving and passing in autos, their shadows elongating on the walls and snapping apart to a singular law. Shudder and finally fall asleep. Did she feel it as I began to eat, to pull the calcium off her shelves, leaving her crumbling teenager's teeth, a mouthful of silver instead of herself? Her husband's features beginning to form, and his mother's lips passing deep into her hips. That's enough of that. Most of the last 6 months has been taken up working on a long poem, which I call the PMS Cafe. And I would like to read you the opening sections. They're called cantos, and canto is nothing but a section of a long poem. So, the PMS Cafe, Canto 1. You'll be meeting my two major characters in this narrative. And, well, I think it's the first epic poem ever to be set in a mall. PMS Cafe, Canto 1. When, in the course of human events, such as shopping, it becomes necessary to try and recall how much credit is left on the card since you've just met with a bargain in petite corporate image sportswear, say, a white silk jumpsuit with buttons down the back, and an impressive British paranoble crest hand tattooed in red and gold metallic thread by Malaysian women on the cigarette pocket, in which no cigarettes were meant to fit. Just met with such a bargain, it will haunt you the rest of your life if you don't buy it. When, in the course of such an event, it becomes necessary to consider a job that pays more money and isn't so degrading. A job you're qualified for but won't get because you're female, won't play politics or something. Your thoughts turn socioeconomic. And you remember the golden age of anger when passion for justice was not a breach of etiquette. Washington and Jefferson's and Hamilton's portraits aren't stamped on money or nothing. Sigh, turn away from the rack, the credit card throbbing from unconsummated foreplay. Where would you wear a silk jumpsuit anyway? It's not like you have any place to look good. Time to take the bus home and brood, but not leave the store through the perfume and makeup department, where women painted up to look predatory, spray passing customers as if with mace, with Elizabeth Giorgio's obsession by Cartier. But this means passing the velvet junkyard of jewelry, where from experience you know you can't resist the purchase of a small sterling treat holding shrimp tails and ram's heads up against your ears and deciding at last you can't do without both. And why should you? You've suffered enough. No one knows. Except perhaps the makeup technicians, all the self-denial that makes a female face, once smooth as glass, like unskated on ice, thaw, crack, and deliquesce. Thus the compulsion to hang unchanging stones and metals from the skin of crepey necks and earlobes and fingers and wrists, cream them, condition the eyelashes even, with expensive nostrums for bitterness. It's all bitterness today. Are you PMS? Wouldn't it be fun to throw a Molotov cocktail and scream slogans loaded with profanities among the padded Olga bras and Vassarette panties, enlightening perhaps a few women who'd join you in the chorus of a radical song you don't know, while torching the whole mess? Then you remember, you're irrational. One night, PMS, you wept for lost kittens and Vietnam veterans, while stuffing your face with Cheetos and Suzy Q's, cooking sherry, tuna, and you went to the drugstore and bought a stick of pepperoni and ate it. Uncontrollably in public on the way home. Normally, you wouldn't care to do this. Then the time you ate the box of 60 Mystic Mints, your hand digging through them with a mind of its own, and you watched yourself as if in a movie, top it all off by cutting off your hair. The next day at work, no one said a thing. But your coworker Sandy, at lunchtime, understanding, brought in a pound bag of Jordan almonds and exchanged them for your peanut butter cups all afternoon, while both of you savaged your boss, old Leadbottom, for being an impotent, cheapo, closet queen who sucked dripping donkey dong. All this you remember on the escalator down, whose walls are lined with mirrors for some reason, throwing in your face the fact that you have periodic acne still at age 31. Canto 2. All women come to cosmetics, if not when young, then when a little broken down. Those lines around the mouth, those violet valleys of natural shadow underneath the eyes, graviers of experience and time, cry out at last for emollients and concealers. A face is like one of those handheld puzzles with square pieces of a face you fingertip around. Play it enough, it becomes insoluble. Problem of problems, vanity of vanities. Why aren't there encouragement counters where old women would say you're lovely because you're wise and sexy with indomitable sexiness? You know yourself from your desires to possess. Now 10 minutes of that, it'd be worth $35. But what adorable two bets and tiny jars arranged in covenantal rainbows, promising sex, sex, sex with wealthy men, sex in the backs of triple stretch limos, diamonds and furs and Riviera summers and giggly private lunches with Jackie or the Queen. Nice work for a girl from the industrial Midwest, where airborne caustics shrivel undies on the line, where the stereo installer at Radio Shack has waited now for 15 years to marry you. His double-wide trailers, double bed all set, as he writes each year in his Valentine. PMS, a maybe, forms in your mind when up ahead at Dior, you see coworker, confidant, Sandy, in the throes of a makeover. Sandy, Sandy, former popular pajama party hostess, fortunate having been born with personality, countess's skin, and grass-green irises. Raised on Lucky Charms and Belgian chocolate, her family let her have her own phone line, a canopied bed, a magic eight ball, a pony. So the only thing she hates are Laura Ashley's dresses and lead bottom. Only in this are you alike. Sandy, bubbly office favorite, a people person, veteran of 10,000 dates. Sandy, who after her granddad kicked the bucket, spent her inheritance on excellent amethyst. When you were a nihilist, she was reading Vogue. When you met at work, you looked at her askance. When you lent her nausea, no exit, and the plague, she said she thought they were hilarious. So, dodging the projectile fantasies among the gold, glass, and sea green counters, the beautiful bride, Isabella Rossellini, and dodging too the counter women's eyes, since you're in jeans and sweatshirt, University of Mars. And belong, it's hopeless to hide it, in Walgreens. From above, you look just like you're being shot at, and you are. But talking with the only optimist you know is worth the risk at the moment. She's blind right now, having shadow applied by a counter woman. Time is carving to a dragon. But Sandy's olfactory powers are exquisite. She can tell Chanel 5 from Chanel 19. She can recognize the milk bath, $2.99 a half gallon at Walgreens, clinging to your skin. Faith? That's right. How's your weekend? A man in Reno shot me just to watch me die. But I didn't. Sandy says, George is in New Jersey, so I tried on shoes last night at Neiman Marcus. Thank God they all were hideous and none of them fit. In Canto 3, begins, if you've been to the new reconstructed gallery out in Clayton, see those gigantic pillars on the outside, and it says St. Louis Galleria, but it doesn't really say it. It says St. Galleria Louis. So I wrote a little bit about St. Galleria to open Canto 3. St. Galleria, second century martyr. Died of shopping in a Cyprian bazaar. She'd won too many times, haggled down to nothing, a hot-blooded infidel lamp oil dealer. She flambéed like bananas, Foster, until her cult was suppressed in 1969 with those of Saints Plaza, Mezzanine, and Christopher. Her holy cards pictured her throttling a horn of plenty, a lit Aladdin's lamp onto her hemline. It's Saint Galleria's aid you seek, tug of warring a leotard with another shopper. It's she in charge of the miracle of finding your perfect outfit in another size's rack. In every mall, Galleria has a chapel. Ever wonder what's behind those drywall screens with stenciled silhouettes of Caucasian shopping people? Sandy and Faith came upon it, looking for the ladies in the featureless beige-painted service maze behind the cookie boutique. This can't be the can, said Faith. It's too dark, and there's not an inch of water, and the room smelled of incense, not a Carolina pine forest in a rain of asafoetida at all. Votive candles spelling out the name Galleria in tame firelight flickered in a corner. The girls jumped a mile when addressed as they were leaving by a female voice as aged and arresting as Queen Victoria's recorded on a cylinder. Welcome, girls, to St. Galleria's Chapel. advice from the wise woman, $5 an hour, on love, sex, money, other agonies, a deal, PhD, philosophy, Cornell, theosophist, 33rd degree, and 87 earth years old. Sandy and Faith were impressed enough to stumble together toward the speaking shadow. "Sit down, lovelies," the wise woman said, from either a wheelchair or filigreed throne. "I used to have a little corner wise woman enterprise, 100 clients daily in my prime. You're Sandy," she said to Sandy, "and you're Faith. I know you since you're my relatives through Eve. Now cross my palm with an Abe Lincoln each, please, and I'll answer questions from you both." "Why?" asked Sandy, laying her $5 down. "Won't George marry me? He's too smart." "Why?" asked Faith. "Am I miserably lonely? You're hostile, rude, and foul-mouthed. Will I ever pay off my credit cards?" "No. Interest rates are only going up." "Are fame and fortune in my future?" "Poverty and obedience, honey." The girls saw now her face beneath the cowl, in her eyes a live alphabet of candlelight. She warned them through lips painted fire and ice to avoid being anybody's first wife. She wore a black high-necked dress, Dior, thought Sandy, 1949, and an Agora Winkit Omnia medallion, silver on her post-lapsarian breast. They glanced at one another. The woman was accurate, no matter how they tested her, on every count. "Give us," they said, "Wednesday's megabucks numbers." And she answered, but they instantly forgot. Faith became depressed beyond redemption. She'd marry a salesman at Radio Shack. And Sandy'd die, except this delighted her, of suffocation from an ill-applied mud pack. "Give me your hands," said the wise one, compassionate. "This isn't a very good century for women. There is, however, the PMS Cafe, where you can eat, drink, use the ladies, and forget. I recommend it highly. Here are directions. Galleria be with you on your next shopping trip." Okay, canto 4, which is the last one from this section. "You need pleasure, preferably sex, but purchases or food will have to do. Independence's substitutes for love include mall walking on a Sunday afternoon. Women are safe here. Men are watching football. May 90% of them watch it forever. Those married, engaged, and homosexual. May the rest be just around the corner, grand opening, the first male brothel. Or failing that, may there be a chocolatier." PMS, you wonder, should you have said Sandy's made-over face recalled a totem pole segment? She'd asked, after all, for an opinion. Did the dragon lady mean something personal when she said you needed psychiatric treatment? Was the wise woman real, or did you hallucinate her the way you rather wonder the same of a show called The Real McCoys with Walter Brennan that no one else seems ever to have seen? After finding the ladies, you discuss it, returning to Galleria Chapel and observing merely sawdust and 2x4s within. Sandy inquires of the mall concierge, who imperially recommends Acid Heads Anonymous. You're hungry, as Proserpina redivivus, so you and Sandy, Lewis and Clarkett, past scenic penny ponds and money trees, to the food court's upscale bakery for rolls and raspberry maple, not oppressed people coffee. The girls can't figure how when they pass 30, they stop losing on French fries and burritos. 3 weeks a month they eat fish and salad meals, breakfasting low on the food chain, below plankton and just above gravel. So men should love them for just their low cholesterol. Turned inside out, they'd have more dates than they could handle. Right side out, they have curviform Venus bellies, balancing globular Venus behinds. Really attractive to Haitians and Iraqis. But sneered at by beer-drenched American guys, wanking to Playboy and swimsuit issues. How males can fantasize about women who dial 911 should these gentlemen appear within a 50-yard radius is utterly beyond Faith and Sandy. They eat sweet rolls at the bottom of the mall amid tile and fluorescence a la 1970s drive-in movie ladies' rooms where diaphragms sprang up and over the stalls. Those days are gone, like their virgin distaste for elastic waist pants and canvas espadrilles. Those hip-hugger days are as gone as senior proms, corsages and dancing and heavy petting after.